I'm David Schreiner Khan, and this is Smashing the Plateau. No matter how successful you are, there's probably at least one area where roadblocks are keeping you from fully achieving your goals. Fortunately, you've come to the right place. Every expert I interview on this podcast is different, but they all have one thing in common. They know how to fix problems that keep people stuck. Today, I'm pleased to welcome Rachel Hoppe. Rachel has spent the last 20 years helping organizations implement emerging technologies to advance their business strategies. She understands how networked communications environments can transform how people work, their productivity, and their personal satisfaction by aligning their passions, skills, and relationships. Rachel co-founded the Community Roundtable to support business leaders developing their community and social business strategies. Clients including Steelcase, Aetna, BASF, H&R Block, and CA benefit from Rachel's ability to make sense of abstract trends and her ability to see the implications that technical and operational decisions can have on people and processes. During her career, Rachel has served in analyst, product management, product marketing, and executive roles. Rachel, welcome to the show. It's great to have you on.
David, it's great to be here. Thanks for having me.
Rachel, what experiences have you had that have helped you understand what it takes to smash the plateau?
Well, it's interesting because as I was thinking about this conversation, I was thinking back and I'm in my mid-40s now, and about a decade ago, a little more than a decade ago, I kind of bottomed out both professionally and personally. And there's no motivation like bottoming out to kind of really kind of crystallize action. So it was an interesting time in my life, and it actually turned around relatively quickly, which I think is maybe a little more uncommon. I think people tend to kind of stay and wallow in the shallows longer. I think that's one of my strengths, is I have a bias for action. I don't let myself stay in that state. I think, you know, wallowing is probably the worst choice when faced with anxiety. So we can
talk
about
it more. I agree, by the way. Yeah, I agree. We'll come back to this.
But I really had to have I guess some people call it a come to Jesus moment about, like, I needed to make some radical changes in my life, and I did. And that put me on a different trajectory.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. I've had this conversation a lot with people about the anxiety that accompanies the plateau syndrome, right? So we're in a place where we know we don't want to be where we are for any longer than we have to, yet the next step is one that creates all kinds of fear and anxiety in us. And the more we think about it, the scarier it gets and the harder it is to take that first step, which just perpetuates the plateau. So it's, we might know intellectually that as soon as we take that first step, we're already better off, but taking that first step is so hard.
Yeah. Well, so the one thing I didn't do is I did not ruin a good crisis. You know, and I think other people find themselves at plateaus that are less of a crisis. They're not happy. And I could point to years before the real crisis point that I had and said I probably should have gotten off the trajectory I was on because it wasn't panning out very well. But it wasn't crisis yet. So, you know, I used that crisis to really change things. So I think a lot of people don't have that crisis yet.
Yeah, I think that's true. I mean, I'm thinking about my own life. I had one of those when I was in my late 20s. And I, at that point, I was working as an engineer. And yeah, well, I wasn't super thrilled about what I was doing. I wasn't changing the world. It was okay. But there wasn't something that was really pushing me to take action to do anything differently than what I was doing until the company that I was working for didn't have enough business and suddenly I was unemployed. Well, that was a crisis. And once I made up my mind about what I was going to do, I actually moved very quickly. But there was some wallowing for a while till I figured out what that first step was going to be.
It took more than getting laid off. I work in technology. I was laid off a couple of times, and that wasn't good enough. I really had to sink the ship in some respects to turn it around. But
So what advice can you offer our listeners about how to take that first step, how to make sure that you start moving forward, and what to do afterwards?
Well, I think, one thing that I'm relatively good at is, and it's related to my favorite quote, which is an Annie Dillard quote, "How we spend our days is, of course, how we spend our lives." I'm fairly good at taking a day at a time. I don't worry too much about the future. I don't feel too guilty about the past, because really my area of influence is on today. Like, the only thing I can really do something about is what I do today. And I think if you take that path, you can say, okay, well, what can I do today that changes my trajectory for tomorrow and the next day? And how can I spend less time just worrying about everything else? And I don't know exactly how I got there, but I really, I think I've picked myself up enough times that I know that I was an exchange student back in high school, and I had some very risky excursions where I had no credit card, no cell phone, because it was the mid-80s. And I'd end up at home with, like, 50 cents in my pocket. And I kind of freaked myself out after the fact, but you're young and stupid. But I learned at that point that you're never going to sit on the curb in the rain forever. Like, something will happen. Either you will get bored and eventually get up and walk, or the rain will stop, or someone will come and find you, or something will happen that changes your situation. So I kind of had that background going into my working life. But I think that's really critical for people to understand. Like, worrying just doesn't help. Feeling guilty just doesn't help. I see this I'm a mother as well. I see this with mommy guilt all the time. And I'm like, we're all doing the best that we can. Like, and it's just not worthwhile feeling guilty. If you care, i.e. if you feel guilty, you're doing a good job. So stop thinking about that and go, like, if you're worried about something, go do something different today.
Yeah, we used to tell our kids that nobody trained us to do this, and there's probably going to be something that is going to encourage them to seek therapy at some point and talk about their parents. And we're okay with that.
Yeah. And as long as you're transparent and honest and you apologize when you know you've gone over some limit, I think that's the best that you can do. And actually, it's good modeling for your kids to see that, none of us are perfect. So you're going to have to do the best you can. And the best that you can do is make up after something happens.
Right. So, Rachel, I wonder if we could talk a little bit about what kinds of help you have seen as being really instrumental when individuals, and particularly when people who are in leadership roles, seem to be stuck at a plateau.
So two things happened to me when I had my crisis, I guess I'll call it. My early midlife crisis. I was living out in Silicon Valley at the time, and I decided to move back to Boston. So that was one. I just up and left. change of scene. I knew I needed a change of scenery, and it was really impulsive, didn't make a lot of sense, but I knew I needed to kind of just change my surroundings. I then found a job where I had this boss who was miraculous, and she saw something special and unique and valuable in me in a way that nobody ever else had, certainly not a work colleague. She thought that I was really insightful. And for most of my work life, I I don't know. I don't want to say I was stupid, but like my brother was brilliant growing up. I did okay for myself, but I certainly didn't consider myself worthy of pursuing what was most exciting to me. I just didn't feel qualified. And she saw something in me and reflected back to me what she saw, which was incredibly valuable to understand what I had unique to contribute to the world. At the same time, on the personal side, I met my husband, who also found some unique and very valuable things about me. So I had these two people in my life who reflected back the best of me to myself in a way I just had never had before. And they saw me in a light that I didn't see myself in. And so when I coach people now, I like finding that person that can see that in you and reflect it back to you is super critical. It's just, it changed my life.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I can see it. It is a game changer. How do you, so if you don't have somebody like that in your life, what do you do? Do you go out and look for somebody like that?
From my perspective, you find, it's about like, and in some ways this gets to my work, it's finding your community, it's finding your tribe, it's networking and refusing to stop networking until you find that person. And networking has kind of gotten this dirty word because it's like it conjures up images of like, you know, old fat guys exchanging business cards in a hotel lobby, which is that's not beneficial networking at all. I don't want to see anybody's business card. That's not what I care about. It's about really connecting with people. And so it's fine. Like you can do that at all sorts of events and you can do that at bars and you can do that at the gym and you can do that at work. And I don't know that I realized the strength of that until after the fact, but it's going out and meeting people until you find that person. And you're more likely to meet that person if you go to events where you're interested in the topic of the event, clearly. So it's not random networking. It's really trying to build relationships with people who care about the same things you do.
Mm. So it's really it's intentional networking or intentional yes. relationship building.
Yeah, it's not just sporadic, like I'm going to talk to everybody. It's finding the things you care about, finding out where people are talking about those things, and going out of your way to go to those things, forcing yourself to go through some of that awkwardness of kind of getting yourself enmeshed in a group of people. That's hard for everybody. But if I had any advice, it's keep doing that until you find those people that can really appreciate you.
Mm. And now, is there a point at which it makes sense to stop doing this relationship building because you've met some of those people?
I don't think I'll ever stop networking. I find people fascinating. So that's my own proclivity. I don't know if everybody needs to do that. But I think, you know, what I've learned over the years, and I'm in the relationship business, sort of. So take that with a grain of salt. But I think it's all about relationships. So relationships are what are the container for trust. Trust is what allows us to really listen to each other. It's what allows us to challenge each other in a supportive way versus a way that makes us defensive. So the only way we can thrive is through each other. We can't do it on our own.
We can't do it on our own.
I don't think you can do it on your own, because to me, success is defined by your impact on the world, on other people. And that requires the other person and that exchange and collaboration with somebody else. So there's the great scientists who go off by themselves. But if nobody knows what they're working on, if nobody is generating new ideas into their ecosystem, they stall out.
So do you think that there's a myth around the success of the individual? Talk to me about that.
Well, I just don't. I think the people who are successful and don't realize it's relationships don't see the lack of relationships, meaning there are people in the world who have always gone through life having kind of a fantastic community or set of relationships. And because they've never not had it, they don't really realize the power that it's given them and the access that it's given them. And I think it's much easier to see the power of that when you're disenfranchised for some reason, when you're outside of the ability to have a constructive community or have constructive relationships, you really understand what it does for you. But if you live your life in that stream and never outside of that stream, you think, oh, well, you know, I just worked really hard. But you, what you don't realize is that community set expectations for you. That community taught you how to behave in a way that was acceptable to the power structures. They did a lot for you that you didn't even kind of realize they were doing.
And how does the model behind the community roundtable fit into this, into some of these ideas?
Well, so for me, it's about creating organizations and communities where individuals can thrive. So I don't think individuals thrive if the community around them is not thriving. And so fundamentally, it's not just about transforming organizations. It's about supporting kind of humanity at the grossest level. But like, if you want an organization where people are going to do more for you, you've got to help them understand their unique, special value and how to really use that to help themselves and help the organization. Because when they understand that, they move from a reactive place to a proactive place. They understand how they can help others then.
So what are maybe some stories or examples of the way this plays out and can work really well?
I'll go to my own life because I know that one the best. Because I had all this support, I actually left this amazing boss because the organization was awful. And I went to another job, but then, you know, the economy tanked. I lost that job. And I started a company. And I had no intent ever to start a company. But that gave me the confidence to at least try and say, well, I have something unique and special that other people can't quite see that I think has value. And that's the nugget of, you know, maybe I'll start my own thing. Maybe I'll pursue something that gets you there, right? If you don't have that little nugget, you can't build anything great. And so, you know, I went out and, you know, when we started the company, it was, I want to say it's relatively casual. We didn't have a grand plan. We had an idea. We went and the first thing we did is went to South by Southwest that year because we knew a lot of our colleagues and peers and our network would be there. And we knew there was a lot of people who could give us feedback on what we were doing. And we got enough support there that we were like, yeah, I think this is an okay idea. And as we went through the business, there's these little markers in time that you can point to that are significant inflection points. So we got a lead maybe a year, year and a half, 2 years in. Somebody had taken our model and our research and created and it was at a Fortune 500 company. They took this model, they created an entire roadmap, gap analysis, and plan for companies at that organization. And it hit me like lightning because they had basically taken what we created, self-validated themselves as a client. When they came in, it took me 15 minutes to half an hour to close them, even though I didn't even know this company was watching us, let alone that they were doing anything with communities or who the people involved were. But by kind of proactively sharing myself, I attracted the people who could also make me successful. So it's a really win-win. It's this generative business model. I don't know. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it sounds also like it, like it's like part of your perhaps growth, but the strategy behind how you developed your business has to do with how you interacted with your community to get feedback, which then, because of the feedback, it also fueled your growth.
Yep, absolutely. And so now we do benchmarks. That it took us 4 years to get there because we didn't have the data, but our clients show us the way. And some of our clients show us the way and don't really have budget to pay us for extensive advisory services. But other, we can take their work or take their example, turn that into services and sell it to other people who don't have the resources to do it themselves. And so it's this continual dialogue and sharing that generates more value than we collectively put into the community. It's really cool to see it grow that way.
It sounds in some ways very organic.
It is, but it's also facilitated, right? Like, we know what we're doing at some level, so we're very intentional about prompting our members to share stuff so that we can see it, so that we can learn from what they're doing, so that we can compound what they know with what we know and deliver that back out to the market. It is a very generative process and kind of organic process. And because of that, one of the things I think I'm probably most proud of is we have hundreds of clients, and over the years, fewer than one handful of them have had kind of an antagonistic conversation with me. Like, we have very low stress client relationships.
That's actually quite remarkable. However, listening to how you've developed your business and understanding that you're listening and responding to the needs that your customers articulate to you, that makes total sense.
And in fact, like, in some ways, we don't really want to work with difficult clients.
Well, I think in the abstract, most people don't. But on the other hand, a lot of people do. A lot of people do work with difficult clients and don't understand that they're in as much control of the relationship with their clients as their clients are.
Yeah. And it's helpful that, you know, over the years we've built enough business that we don't have to, meaning we're not, we don't have to take revenue. We've maintained private ownership for that reason. Like, you know, we definitely, one of the reasons we set up the business the way we did is to have that level of control. So we never felt like we needed to do something that just wasn't working out well.
Yeah, that makes perfect sense. Rachel, whom do you know personally who has done really remarkable work?
So there's a few people that I look to and look up to they all fall kind of in the small, medium business sphere because they're the people I'm inspired by. But Anne McCrossan in the UK, who runs Visceral Business, is remarkable. Christopher Parsons runs a little technology company called Knowledge Architecture. And is just really thoughtful and collaborative. I really respect him. Nico Mille, who was in politics on the digital side and now runs the Shorenstein Center at the Kennedy School at Harvard, but also ran a digital agency for years. I really respect his work. And then C.D. Harquell, does a lot of, she's a business professor and has done a lot of work around generative business models. So those are four people who I really think are doing really interesting and remarkable work.
Those are great examples. Thank you. And what can we look forward to in the near future from you? What's coming up for you personally and with your business?
Well, so communities are in the spotlight. They've gotten a lot of executive attention lately. And I think that's because, you know, community's always been a implicit role of leadership, but now is becoming a lot more explicit as digital transformation happens. And so the community space is colliding with the leadership space. It's colliding with the learning and development space. So I'm doing a lot of work in that area. But I'm really excited this year because last year we published a community ROI model that has been really well received. This year, we're really digging in and helping our clients build historical ROI models and projecting future growth. And that's a little bit like community nirvana. It's when I started the business, I really wanted to be able to do that kind of business modeling, and we just didn't have the data or the models to do it. And now we do. And that means organizations and individuals can really plan for success instead of just waiting for it, which is pretty exciting to me.
That's pretty powerful, actually. Who wouldn't want to plan for success rather than waiting for it?
It is pretty exciting.
Rachel, how can listeners learn more about you and your work?
Well, our corporate website is communityroundtable.com, and I am on Twitter at RHAPPE, so RHAPPE on Twitter, and they can email me at rachel@communityroundtable.com.
Great. Well, Rachel, it's been great having you on Smashing the Plateau today, talking about plateaus, and in particular, how communities are so important to help us navigate the narrow places in life and in business, and to help us really succeed in big ways. So,
great.
Yeah, thank you so much for coming on the show today. My guest today has been Rachel Hoppe, the co-founder of the Community Roundtable. Thank you again, Rachel, for joining us.
Thanks for having me, David.
Thank you for listening to Smashing the Plateau, the podcast produced by Tend Strategic Partners. I hope you enjoyed our discussion. Have you ever hit a plateau in your own life or career? If so, let's talk. It would be my pleasure to take you through one of our free half-hour discovery sessions, where we'll get to the bottom of what might be keeping you stuck and how to move things forward. Just give me a call at 212-731-0770. That's 212-731-0770. You never know what you might find out.